Well, we need to start a new unit since you just finished an exam. And from now on, the units are not only more specialized as far as topics are concerned, but they'll also all be 3 chapters long only, which means that tests will happen a little bit more often now. That first one took longer to go through, which is why we're a quarter of the way through the term as far as the calendar is concerned, but we've only taken 1 of 5 tests. Anyway, the second unit opens up with the chapter we're looking at the beginning of right now, which is a chapter that finally concentrates on these 4 categories of biological macromolecules that we've been talking about already. What are the categories quickly? Of biological macromolecules. Polypeptides, polysaccharides, lipids, and nucleic acids, exactly. And before we look at this first slide, let me say that 3 of those categories, in addition to being macromolecules, all 4, of course, are macromolecules, but 3 of those are more specifically qualify as polymers. Polymer linguistically means many part. A polymer is not only a macromolecule, it's built a specific way. Polymers are built by hooking together a bunch of subunits, each of which is called a monomer, which linguistically means one part. So of those 4 categories of macromolecules, which one is not actually a polymer? Any guess, or do you know? Yeah. Lipids, that's correct. Lipids are big molecules, so they are macromolecules, but they are not built by stringing together a bunch of monomers. They're built differently. I mention that right now not only because it's important, but because it explains, I wanted to warn you about something on this first slide. Notice that the first slide uses a polymer as an example, which would exclude lipids, but the important thing about slide 1 that I'm about to talk about actually applies to all 4 categories, including lipids. So the polymer example is just an example. It's not necessary here. What's important about this first slide is that these macromolecules don't just happen, of course. They are built. Cells make bigger things out of smaller things, and they reverse the process as well. They break bigger things into smaller pieces. And so you see 2 processes here in A and B. In the top part, A, we're building a bigger thing out of smaller pieces. All right? Now, this involves a specific kind of chemical reaction, which you can see labeled here as a dehydration reaction. A dehydration reaction in terms of metabolism, remember that metabolism is the overall set of all reactions occurring in an organism. Well, there are 2 subsets to metabolism, which are anabolism, and we'll talk more about this later, it's really from a different unit, and catabolism. But anabolism is the part of metabolism in which you're building bigger things out of smaller. Catabolism is breaking bigger things into smaller pieces. Well, dehydration is a chemical reaction that links 2 smaller things together to make a bigger thing. And no matter which of the 4 categories we're talking about of macromolecules, when you build them out of smaller things, one of those smaller things is going to have an H sticking off somewhere, and the other smaller piece is going to have an OH somewhere on it, sticking off. And both of these are removed. The H is removed from one piece, the OH is removed from another piece. And an H and an OH, when you combine them, make a water, H2O, that comes out. That's why it's called dehydration, which means removal of water. But think about this in terms of ball and stick models. If you remove an H from one model and an OH from another model, you're leaving two holes, basically, right? Which allows you then to sew the two pieces together with a wooden stick. That's the bond that's being formed here, in this case, between 3 and 4. So you're making a bigger piece out of two smaller pieces. That's what dehydration is used for in cells. Some books would call this a condensation reaction, but dehydration is actually more descriptive. But you can use either of those terms. They're interchangeable. On the bottom, we see the exact reverse process. Like I said earlier, cells not only build bigger things out of smaller pieces, they also break bigger things down into smaller pieces. And the exact reverse of dehydration reaction is a hydrolysis reaction. The lysis part of that word hydrolysis means splitting. Okay? To lyse is to split. Well, water itself is split in this process, but also the big piece of whatever molecule you're talking about gets split as well. Notice it's the reverse of dehydration. In dehydration, water comes out. In hydrolysis, water is required. You need water to go in, because when you split that water, you're going to split it into an H and an OH. The H goes on to one of the two pieces that gets split from the big piece, and the OH gets hooked onto the other, just like you see here. All right? So hydrolysis splits bigger things into smaller things. All right, that was a generalized slide. Now for the rest of the slideshow, we'll take a closer look one by one at each of these four biological macromolecule categories, beginning with polysaccharides. But slide 2, which is the beginning of the polysaccharides section of the chapter, does not show you any polysaccharides. All of these examples that you see here, I guess there's 7 molecules shown here. None of these is a polysaccharide. All of these are monosaccharides. So we mentioned that 3 of the categories of macromolecules are polymers. Polysaccharides is one of those, and the name kind of shows you that it's a polymer, right? A polysaccharide is a large carbohydrate made out of many small carbohydrates called monosaccharides that are hooked together. These haven't been hooked together. Monosaccharides are full molecules in their own right. Monosaccharides are simple sugars. All right. But if you hook them together, you can make a polymer called a polysaccharide, a complex sugar. Just one more thing about the word carbohydrate that I just used. You might have learned about these 4 categories of macromolecules before in high school maybe or something, and you might have learned that one of the categories was carbohydrates. But that's not actually correct. And if you learn that again in a different course, feel free to correct your instructor. Carbohydrates is not one of the categories of macromolecules, because not all carbohydrates are macromolecules. Carbohydrates is a very general term. Carbohydrates include polysaccharides, which are, of course, macromolecules, but it also includes small molecules, small sugars, which are monosaccharides. Okay? So if you want to list categories of macromolecules, you list only the large carbohydrates, the ones that are macromolecules, and those are polysaccharides. Okay, now, what do you see that every one of these 7 monosaccharides listed here, and that's just 7 of many, many possible monosaccharides. It's not a complete list by any means. But what do all 7 of these have in common? Well, yes, they all have a carbon skeleton, so they are organic. That's actually true for all four categories of macromolecules that we're looking at. They're not only biological macromolecules, they're all organic macromolecules. What more specifically do they have in common? Right, every one of them features a carbonyl group, which is the thing that's highlighted in orange or salmon or whatever color this is. All right, monosaccharides in general are carbonyl-containing compounds, at least when they are in the linear form. Remember last week's laboratory, where we discussed the fact that a monosaccharide can exist in either linear or ringed form. These are all the linear forms of these monosaccharides. Carbohydrates, as a word, I told you earlier when we talked about hydrocarbons not to confuse it with carbohydrates. Carbohydrates are named for the fact that monosaccharides are have chemical formula that seem like they are part carbon and part water. The generalized formula would be CnH2ON. Carbon and water is what it looks like. But when you use distributive property, that would be CnH2NON. All right. All of these have that same general formula where N is a different number depending on the carbohydrate. Well, that brings up one of two ways that this slide is illustrating that you can categorize monosaccharides. One way is based on how big the carbon skeleton is. In other words, what N is in this general formula. So glyceraldehyde and dihydroxyacetone, both in the first column, they have exactly the same chemical formula, C3H6O3, which means they have what relationship to each other? If they have the same chemical formula, what can you say about them? What's the word we would use to describe them? Yes, they are isomers of each other. Isomers have exactly the same chemical formula, but they're different substances. But anyway, the point here is that there's many, many monosaccharides, and you can categorize them based on how big the carbon skeleton is, how many carbons are in them. The general suffix that denotes that we're talking about a carbohydrate, whether it's a monosaccharide or a polysaccharide, is OSE. OS means you're talking about some sort of carbohydrate or sugar. Trios is therefore is a category that means three carbon sugars. These are pentoses because they all have five carbons. The one you built with ball and stick was glucose, which is just one of many possible hexoses, six carbon sugars. So the columns show you one way of categorizing monosaccharides. The rows show you an entirely different way of categorizing them that has nothing to do with the first way. So now we're back to this fact that monosaccharides contain a carbonyl somewhere. Well, think back to when we first learned about the carbonyl group. There's two ways that that carbonyl can be situated within the carbon skeleton, right? Which is why there are two different categories of carbonyl-containing compounds. What are the categories? Ketones and aldehydes. Aldehydes have their carbonyl at a tip of the skeleton. Ketones have their carbonyl not at the tip, not at any tip, somewhere within the skeleton itself. Well, notice that all the ones in the first row have carbonyls at the tip. So they are all aldehydes, but they're also sugars. So that category gets the name aldoses, aldehyde sugars. All the ones on the bottom row are ketoses, ketone sugars. Okay. Slide 3 reminds you, this basically is the same thing you saw in lab that we talked about in lab last week. But this reminds you of what we've already learned, namely that any given monosaccharide can exist in either linear form, which can also be called acyclic, because it's not a ring, a cycle, or ringed form, which can be called the cyclic version. And notice the double arrows here, meaning that this reaction, this change in shape, can occur in either direction. And typically, a monosaccharide that is on its own, which is a molecule in its own right, will go back and forth between those forms many times per second. But importantly, as far as polysaccharides, which we're building to here, are concerned, when a monosaccharide is in its ringed form, and you can imagine doing this even though you didn't build the ringed form, but imagine your model that you built, which was the linear form. If you wanted to wrap that carbon skeleton around on itself to make a ring, you couldn't do it unless you broke some bonds, right? So notice that only in the linear form does a monosaccharide have a double bond here, the carbonyl group. When you wrap it around to make the ringed form, you have to remove that double bond so that you can sew those two carbons together to complete the ring. It's still the same monosaccharide when it's in the ringed form, but it no longer has a carbonyl group, right? And to explain last week, if you still don't understand those chemical tests, the only way that you can hook two monosaccharides together to build a bigger sugar is if they're in the ringed form. All right? And the ringed forms don't have these double bonds, which means they are not reducing sugars. This is why Benedict's test fails if you have a disaccharide, a two-part sugar, or a polysaccharide, a big many-part sugar, because they're all locked in that ringed form. None of them has a carbonyl to donate the electron to copper 2 to make it into copper 1. Only individual, on their own monosaccharides have that carbonyl group, and that's why those are called reducing sugars. Okay, well, let's use these monomers, these monosaccharides, to build bigger carbohydrates. That's what's shown in slide 4. For instance, you can take two glucoses. Notice that this follows the general scheme that I talked about in slide 1. One of these is going to have an OH somewhere. One of them is going to have an H somewhere. You lose the OH and the H together as water, and that allows you to covalently bond the two things together to make a bigger thing. In this case, two glucoses, the smaller things, are joined to make a bigger thing, which is called maltose. Notice the OSE ending again on all these. Maltose, though, is not a monosaccharide. It's made of two monosaccharides covalently bonded, and therefore it's called a disaccharide. Still not a polysaccharide, because poly means many, di means two. You're not really at many yet. But it's bigger than a monosaccharide. So what kind of reaction does this? You can cheat and look, but you've just learned that it's a dehydration that does this, right? When water is removed. But the bond, dehydration is the chemical reaction. It results in a covalent bond, though. And we give that covalent bond a special name when we're talking about two monosaccharides specifically being hooked together. And that specific name is called a glycosidic linkage. Glyco, you see in several words, means sugar. All right? Well, maltose is just one of many possible disaccharides. Any disaccharide is just two monosaccharides hooked together. But since there are many different kinds of monosaccharides, you can have many different kinds of disaccharides. Sucrose is what we usually mean when we just say sugar. Sucrose is table sugar. But it's a disaccharide that's made by hooking a glucose and a fructose together. You still use the same technique, though, dehydration, to do it, and you still form a glycosidic linkage between them. It's just two different monosaccharides in this case. All right, now before we leave this slide, I want you to notice that monosaccharides in the ringed form, which they have to be in order to be linked together, have not only an OH, which is part of this dehydration requirement, they have multiple places where there's an H or an OH. The blue ones are just the ones that happen to be involved this time, but notice there's other H's and OH's on that same sugar, which means that monosaccharides can or feature multiple places where you can hook another monosaccharide to it, not just one place. And that means if you do hook monosaccharides together to form polysaccharides, those polysaccharides can branch. If there were only one place to hook them, and you hook a bunch of them together, it would not be branching, right? Kind of like those plastic kids' toys that you hook them together to make long strands. Those don't branch, right? Because there's only one way you can hook them to the next one. And we'll see that that's true for other kinds of macromolecules, but not for polysaccharides, because the monomers have multiple connection points, not just one. Well, finally, let's get to an official polysaccharide, slide 5. There's actually 3 different polysaccharides shown here: amylose, amylopectin, and glycogen. But there's a couple things to say about these specific examples. They're all polysaccharides because they include many monomers hooked together, not just 2. Every one of these green hexagons is one monosaccharide, or was one monosaccharide originally. Now there's a hell of a lot of them hooked together. And notice that you see some branching that I was just talking about because of these multiple places where the monosaccharide in ringed form can hook. So these are all polysaccharides. More specifically, though, these happen to be polysaccharides made up entirely of one type of monosaccharide, just a lot of them. Every one of these green hexagons is a glucose. It doesn't have to be the case. You can make polysaccharides out of other monosaccharides as well. But in a lot of organisms, glucose is used as a monomer. Glucose, by the way, is the master fuel, not only in your own cells, but in all cells in general, all kinds of organisms. Monosaccharides are the primary fuels in organisms. So they store energy. And they store energy in the form of carbon-hydrogen bonds. And carbon-carbon bonds, but they have both. All right. Unit 3 will be devoted to talking about how fuels are used to provide energy for the various things that cells need to do to keep you alive or keep any organism alive. So that's what I mean by fuels. Fuels are molecules that can be broken down to release energy. And monosaccharides are the chief fuels. In your own body, your brain, except under extraordinary circumstances like starvation, your brain uses nothing but glucose as fuel, which is why your body has evolved to make sure that the brain has a continuous supply. Whether you're taking glucose in or not, you're going to make glucose if there's none available from the food that's coming in to keep you alive. The other parts of the body can use glucose, but other things as well as fuel. All right, but anyway, that's an important thing about monosaccharides. Well, we're focusing here on polysaccharides. And I mentioned this use of fuel this use of monosaccharides as fuel, because when it comes to polysaccharides, there are 2 major functional categories. All 3 of these that you see on here are examples of the same category. So these show just one of the 2 categories, but let me give you the 2 categories. Those 2 categories of polysaccharides are storage polysaccharides, which these are all examples of in this slide, and the other category is structural polysaccharides. Okay, so amylose and amylopectin are both examples of starches. Starch is what plants make as their storage polysaccharides. We animals make glycogen as our version of storage polysaccharides. But the reason that they are considered to be storage polysaccharides is that they are built for the purpose of storing more efficiently monosaccharides that can be used as fuel later. All right, so in your own body, this is a major function of your liver. It has a lot of functions, but this is an important one. Right after a meal, no matter what you eat, it contains a lot of glucose. It could be in the form of starch when you eat it. If you eat a plant, you can take it in starch, but you can't take starch into the body. It's too big. So your digestive system digests it into individual glucoses while it's still outside your body. You know, what you put into your body, what you take in as food, that is not in your body. The alimentary canal is a continuous tube running from mouth to anus. And the interior of that, which is where you put the food, is not in your body. Your body just wraps around that tube. Notice that it's continuous with the air, right? All the way to the anus. That's still outside your body. The digestive system breaks big macromolecules into smaller pieces that can then be absorbed into the cells of the body. That occurs at the small intestine. Anyway, you're taking in a lot of glucose from the food you eat, more than you need at the moment, which is why your blood glucose level will go up right after digestion, right after absorption, which, of course, after digestion. And the liver responds by taking a bunch of that glucose out of the blood, because it's higher than it should be, and hooking them together to make glycogen, a storage polysaccharide, because the intent here is to simply store them in a more compact form by hooking them together, because later you're going to need those individual glucose molecules as fuel. Hours later, if you still haven't eaten, your brain is continuously using glucose to remain alive, and so eventually the glucose level in your blood will go below normal. And that's when the liver gets its signal to reverse the process. It will take the glucose that it made earlier and break them into the glycogen that it made earlier, and break that glycogen into individual glucose molecules, put it into the bloodstream to keep your brain and therefore you alive. Okay? So that's what a storage polysaccharide is for. It's built just for the purpose of storing glucose as energy, or monosaccharides, but it's almost always glucose. Now, structurally speaking, we animals make glycogen, which is very similar to starch, but notice that it has much more branching in glycogen. And this is for good reason. Animals are much more active than plants, metabolically speaking, so they need energy much more quickly when they do need it. Well, you can't use the glycogen, you can't burn glycogen for energy, you can only burn the monomers that it's made out of. So you have to break glycogen apart so you get those individual glucoses which you can then burn. And you can break apart a glycogen much more quickly because all of this branching means there's a lot of tips. And you can take glucoses off of all those tips at the same time, meaning it can be broken down a lot faster than it can in plants. Okay, those are storage polysaccharides. Slide 6 shows you starch again on the left bottom. That's a storage polysaccharide. But on the bottom right, you see cellulose, which is an example of the other category, structural polysaccharides. A structural polysaccharide can be made out of nothing but glucose, which cellulose is, but it's made not for the purpose of storing that glucose for later use as a fuel. Instead, a structural polysaccharide is a much more permanent structure, built for a molecule, I should say, built for the purpose of being a structural element in a cell, or even outside of a cell. Now, glucose is the only monomer being used here, but there's actually two versions of glucose. I've already told you that glucose can be either linear or ringed, but actually there's two different ringed versions as well. Alpha glucose and beta glucose are both glucose, but they're different from each other slightly, very slightly. The only difference here is the position of this hydroxyl shown in blue. If it's above the level of the plane, then it's beta glucose. If it's below, it's alpha glucose. Very minor difference, but it makes a difference when you hook them together to build polysaccharides. If you use alpha glucoses, you're making starch. Or if a plant does, we don't even make starch. If you're using beta glucoses, when you hook them together, you make a structural polysaccharide called cellulose. And so plants make both of these, but for different reasons. Cellulose is a major component of the cell wall, which we haven't studied yet, but all cells, of course, have a plasma membrane, including plant cells. But in exterior to that, a plant cell has something we animals don't have on our cells, which are cell walls, much thicker than the plasma membrane and outside of it. And that's constructed in plants mostly out of cellulose. Okay, which is there to be a rigid structural material. We can see this happening in slide 7. So each of these long strands made up of individual green glucoses, beta glucoses, glycosidically linked, is one strand of cellulose. Each strand is like one strand in a rope. If you have a bunch of them in parallel, side by side, bundled together, you make a much stronger and wider diameter rope. That's a structural element. It's there for the purpose of being a structure, not for being storage of energy. Even though the glucose it's made out of could be used as energy if you dismantled it. Okay, but that's why it's a functional categorization when we say structural or storage polysaccharide. In 8, we see a fellow mammal, this cow, eating grass, which of course is a plant. Grasses have a lot of cellulose. Plants in general have a lot of cellulose because of these cell walls. Well, we humans cannot get any nutritional value out of cellulose. It's considered roughage for us, even though it's made out of nothing but glucose, which is the main fuel. So it's really chock full of energy in terms of fuel. We just can't break it apart to make the individual glucoses, which we could then use as fuel. So we can't digest it, and therefore it just passes through our alimentary canal or digestive tract. We don't absorb anything. We can't get any nutritive value. Neither can a cow as a fellow mammal. It's very similar to us mammals. But it does get nutritional value from it anyway. Not because the cow is breaking down the cellulose, but because bacteria that live in one of the stomachs of the cow have the ability to break them down. This is an example of a special ecological relationship. It's more of a 182 thing, but it's an example of symbiosis. Osis means condition, bio means life, and sim means together. So symbiosis means the condition of living together, meaning two species having a close living arrangement. And this is more specifically an example of endosymbiosis, which is a symbiosis in which one of the two species lives inside the other species. So the bacteria that live inside the cow do have the ability to break the bonds between the beta glucoses that make up cellulose. We humans can't do that. And the reason that we can't is because we don't have the right enzymes, which are proteins, that can break those glycosidic linkages. Why is it that we can't make that kind of protein? How does any cell know how to make a protein? Right. You have to have a gene, which is a set of instructions for indirectly how to make that protein. Well, mammals don't have that gene, but bacteria do, which is why this works. And so not only is this endosymbiosis, but it's also an example of mutualism, which means that both of the species involved benefit from the arrangement, which doesn't have to be true. Could be that one benefits and one gets harmed in it. But they both benefit here. The bacterium gets a continuous supply of free food, as long as the cow is eating. And it gets to stay in a nice, moist, temperature-controlled environment, safe from other things that could kill it. And so the bacterium doesn't give a damn about the cow, of course. That's not why it's breaking down cellulose. It's doing that so that it can use the glucose for itself. But in the process, a lot of glucose gets absorbed by the cow, so the cow clearly benefits as well. Slide 9 is here just to indicate that plants are not the only organisms that make structural polysaccharides. Some animals make a version called chitin. Insects have skeletons that are different from ours. We have an endoskeleton, which means the hard part is inside us. Skeletons have soft bodies throughout their thickness, and their hard part is exterior to that, which is why they have exoskeletons. And a chief component of insect exoskeleton is an animal version of a structural polysaccharide called chitin. And we take advantage of the strength of it by using it to make some kinds of surgical thread. Yeah, the exoskeleton, which is what this insect is shedding at the moment so it can grow, very vulnerable part of its lifetime because it's entirely soft now. It's not protected. But as they grow, they can make new exoskeletons.
No, but that's what...
This is the exoskeleton, and it's made mostly out of chitin, which is an animal version of a structural polysaccharide.
Okay.
It's this molecule here. Or that's the monomer. All right, that is the polysaccharide section of the chapter. Now we'll go in slide 10, is that 10, to lipid as a category. Remember, lipids are the ones that are not polymers. They're bigger molecules, though, so they are macromolecules. They're just built a little bit differently. There are different categories of lipids, subcategories of lipids. We're looking at just one of the important ones here. And only on the bottom is the complete molecule. This bottom thing, which is partly gray and three orange tails, is a single fat. And so I don't want you to make the error of equating or using interchangeably the words fat and lipid, which I hear people doing fairly often. All fats are lipids, but not all lipids are fats. So fat is just a subset of the category lipids. It's the one we're looking at here. But a fat is built a specific way. We can see the process at the top. In gray, what we have, if you just ignore everything else, the gray thing, if it occurs by itself, is a full-blown molecule in its own right called glycerol. What do you know about glycerol based on its name? It's an alcohol, which means what? It has at least one hydroxyl. In fact, it has three hydroxyls, so glycerol is not only an alcohol, it's a triple alcohol. All right? Anyway, glycerol can exist by itself as a complete molecule, but it's just one of four parts that need to be hooked together if you're going to build a bigger thing called a fat. Now, a fat, that's just one of three possible names for it. It's usually the one people like to say or spell because it's easier. But there are two more descriptive names for a fat, and they're completely interchangeable. It doesn't matter which one you use. Most biologists would call a fat a triglyceride. Most biochemists would call it a triacyl glycerol. And most dietitians would call it a fat. They all mean the same thing. But these are more descriptive words because it kind of tells you how they're built. To build a fat, you need four pieces, one of which is a glycerol. So as I just said, it has three hydroxyls. Well, those hydroxyls, of course, contain an H, which is one of the requirements for a dehydration reaction, right? Which you use to link things together. So that means there's three important connection points on glycerol if you want to use dehydration reactions to hook something to it. The thing in orange just by itself is also a complete molecule if it's not hooked to anything else. And it is, in this case, palmitic acid is just one example. There's many different fatty acids, but it's a fatty acid. And a fatty acid has, in this case, the left end of it, has what kind of functional group? What's the left end of the fatty acid here?
Carboxyl.
It's a carboxyl, exactly. And if it weren't for that carboxyl, if you look at just the rest of the molecule, how would you describe that? If the rest of the molecule, other than, and it didn't have the carboxyl, if the rest of the molecule was just as listed, what would it qualify as? A hydrocarbon. A fatty acid is not a hydrocarbon because the carboxyl ruins it since it has oxygen in it, right? But it's almost a hydrocarbon. And hydrocarbons in general, whether it's gasoline or any other hydrocarbon, make excellent fuels, which is why gasoline exists as a fuel. It's really just a mixture of a bunch of hydrocarbons. The reason that hydrocarbons in general make excellent fuels is because there's a lot of potential chemical energy locked up in a carbon-hydrogen bond, just like the carbon-hydrogen bonds that are in monosaccharides, which I already told you are the primary fuels in cells. Well, fatty acids are also rich sources of energy. Now, a fatty acid is just one of these hydrocarbon tails with a carboxyl at the end. But since the carboxyl contains an OH, it can be removed along with an H of a glycerol's hydroxyl to take water out in a dehydration reaction to link that fatty acid to the glycerol. If you did that with just one fatty acid, what you would have is a monoglyceride. But there are two more connection points on that same glycerol. So you can also do the same thing with two more fatty acids to form a triglyceride. This four-part thing overall is one fat or triglyceride or triacyl glycerol. And in this case, and this doesn't have to be true, but in this case, the same exact fatty acid or three copies of the same fatty acid were used. You wouldn't have to do that, though. You could use any fatty acid you want. Palmitic acid is just one type of fatty acid. But the same fat can contain three of the same, two of the same, and one other, or three different fatty acids. Fats, I'll get back to this notion that there are different kinds of fatty acids in a second, but fats have a couple major uses. One is that it is a very efficient way of storing energy. We talk about storage polysaccharides, but fats are a more efficient way to store energy because they have a much higher energy density. Energy density refers to how much energy is stored in 1 gram of that stuff. And compared to carbohydrates or proteins, which are the other two major nutrient classes besides fats when it comes to food, fats store more than twice as much energy per gram than either a carbohydrate or a fat, or a protein does. This is why when we take in more energy in the form of food than we need at the moment, we're going to store most of it as fat. Candy manufacturers love to say, no fat. Put that on the label when it's like a Jolly Rancher, for instance. Nothing but sugar, really, right? Of course, there's no fat there. So it is true. They can sell it as no fat. But if you're taking in more than you need, your body's going to turn it into fat to store it. Because if we stored our extra energy for later, which we've evolved to do because over most of human history there's food shortage. See, we've evolved to hang on to that valuable stuff. But if we stored it as protein or as carbohydrate, we would have to weigh a lot more because it would take more grams to store that same amount of energy in those less highly dense forms. We store it as fat so that we can not have to use as much energy to walk around. The heavier we get, the more energy we would have to waste just moving around as animals. Okay, so that's a major use of fats. They also, though, fats also provide valuable cushioning. So you see a lot of fat around the kidneys, for instance, to protect those important organs. And we sit on a fat pad. And also fats provide thermal insulation. So they keep the body either cooler or warmer than the environment, depending on what the environment is. They insulate us. Okay, now back to a fat, which includes 3 fatty acids. I said they can be the same or different, but when you look at this slide, all 4 of these fatty acids shown here are the same. They don't have to be, though. How could you make a fatty acid still be a fatty acid but be different from palmitic acid? What could you change? Exactly. To be a fatty acid, you have to have a carboxyl and then a hydrocarbon chain. But there's nothing saying how short or long that chain can be, right? This one happens to end at this carbon, but you can keep it going, or you could have ended sooner, right? So that's one way in which there are different kinds of possible fatty acids, the length of them. There's a different way, though, that fatty acids can be different, and that's illustrated in slide 11. This gives two more definitions. Any given fatty acid is categorized either as a saturated fatty acid or an unsaturated fatty acid. Let me actually go back to 10 for a second to make the point here. Now, what in everyday language does saturated mean? Is that the only context in which you've ever used the word saturate? Have you never used the word saturated before in everyday language? It means full of something, right? There's only so wet you can get a towel. If you put it completely underwater, it is saturated. You're not going to get it any wetter, right? It's holding as much as it can. Well, fatty acids that are said to be saturated get that name because they are holding as many hydrogens as possible. Okay, so you have a given length. You have so many carbons in the skeleton. If every one of the carbon-carbon bonds is a single bond, think about building it with ball and sticks, that means every one of these carbons along the length is going to have two more holes in it, right? And so it can hold two hydrogens. But if you, let's just take these two carbons in the middle here. If you make a double bond between those carbons, the only way you can do that is to remove a hydrogen from each one so that you can turn this into a double bond, right? So if you have one or more double bonds in the carbon skeleton, you don't have room for as many hydrogens. That's why a fatty acid that has only single bonds between the carbons is called a saturated fatty acid. It is saturated with hydrogens. A fatty acid that has at least one double bond is an unsaturated fatty acid, and there can be more than one, which is why we, in food lingo, you might hear the word polyunsaturated fats. Well, a fatty acid is polyunsaturated if there's two or more double bonds. But when we look at slide 11, we can see why this is important biologically. A saturated fatty acid, since it has nothing but single bonds, is nice and straight. The zigzag is just a shorthand notation in organic chemistry. You know, organic chemists quickly got sick of writing all the C's and H's, which is by far most of the atoms in organic compounds. They're C's or H's, along with other things. So they said, well, if we're just talking about C's or H's, let's not bother even writing the letters. Every time that you see a point, either the end or a bend, you assume that there's a carbon there. And then using the valence of carbon, you have to just imagine how many hydrogens are there also to satisfy the valence. All right. So in other words, just a single line like this is really shorthand for that. What is this, by the way? What is it? Ethane, exactly. A two-carbon hydrocarbon. Anyway, if there's only single bonds, then the fatty acid is unbent. But when you make a double bond, that forms a kink, a bend in the fatty acid. Okay? That has important biological implications, which I usually explain by analogy with wires. If you use fairly stiff wire, like coat hanger wire, to represent fatty acids, you can have pieces of wire that are different lengths, because different fatty acids can be different lengths. But if you're working with no bends, if they're all saturated, in other words, then you don't have to be too careful if you throw these into a box, because they will stack neatly together. Very little space between them. On the other hand, if you bend each one, and especially if you bend them at different places, each one, and you kind of haphazardly put them into a box, they're not going to stack together neatly. There's going to be a lot of space between them. Okay, we've up to now been talking about fatty acids. So the word saturated and unsaturated apply to individual fatty acids. When you use fatty acids to build a fat, the fat can be called either saturated or unsaturated as well. An unsaturated fat is one that has at least one unsaturated fatty acid in it.
At least one.
Yes, it can be one, two, or three unsaturated fatty acids. The overall fat is an unsaturated fat. A saturated fat to be saturated has to include all three of its fatty acids being saturated.
So which one's more common?
Well, we animals tend to make our fats saturated. We make more saturated fats as animals compared to plants, which make more unsaturated fats. So our fats being saturated are more compact. Just like the members of a solid. So at room temperature, animal fats tend to be more solid, like butter. But plants have unsaturated fats mostly, and because of that, those bends, it's more space, it's looser. So unsaturated fats from plants tend to be liquid at room temperature. Oils are unsaturated fats. Well, that is not so much about lipids as it is polysaccharides that give them that structure, cellulose and whatnot. And when you get other things like lignin in there, it's not so easy to break. That's wood. But that's not lipids. Lipids are not for structure. Those are polysaccharides or proteins that are for structure. Okay, let's go on to 12. Now, you might glance at this if it didn't have any labels and think that you're looking at a fat, because it's very similar. There's a glycerol, and there's fatty acids connected to it. But this is not a fat, because there are not three fatty acids connected to the glycerol. There's only two. But glycerol is glycerol. It's the same as in a fat. And as I told you, glycerol has three places, three connection points. So it can undergo three connections via a dehydration reaction. Two of those places are occupied by hooking on fatty acids, just like in a fat. But the third place on that same glycerol is used to connect phosphate, the yellow thing here, which you should already know from functional groups. And so this is not a fat. This is a different kind of lipid called a phospholipid. Obviously named for the fact that this phosphate is included. And it is not possible to overstress the importance of this molecule to life. None of us, no organism would exist without this. And that's why that's just one of four very important reasons why phosphate itself is so critical to life. I talked about that when we looked at the functional groups. No cell can exist without phospholipids. And that's because no cell can exist without a plasma membrane, right? Plasma membrane really defines the thing as a cell. Well, the chief structural component of a plasma membrane of any cell that's ever existed is phospholipids. And that's because of something special about phospholipids. Phospholipids are examples of molecules that we say are amphipathic. Now, the pathic or pathos part of this refers to feeling. Of course, the molecule doesn't have any feelings. We just anthropomorphize it or give it human qualities, just to make it easier to talk about. But same root as in sympathy or empathy, pathetic. Amphi means dual or both, like in amphibia, the word amphibian, meaning dual lifestyle. The bi part of amphibian is the same as in biology. An amphibian is an organism that has a dual lifestyle because it spends part of its lifetime in water and part of its lifetime on land. And an amphitheater, another good example. It's partly indoors and partly outdoors. Right? You can sit on the lawn or you can be under the pavilion. Well, amphipathic means having dual preference or dual feeling. An amphipathic molecule gets this name because an amphipathic molecule is one that is polar on one part of the molecule and nonpolar on another part of that same molecule. Now, what is it that gives a molecule polarity? Why is a polar molecule polar? Well, what about the electronegativity? That's right. A bond is polar if the two involved atoms have drastically different values for their electronegativities, because that leads to unequal sharing. One of them is more greedy, right? And that never happens if the two atoms are the same element, right? Regardless of what their electronegativity values are, if they're the same kind of atom, they have equal electronegativity, so no one wins out. So polar bonds are always featuring two different kinds of atoms, like an O and an H in water, like we talked about. Well, a CH bond, carbon-hydrogen, does not involve the same atom, one's carbon and one's hydrogen. But when you look those values up on a periodic table like ptable.com, it's not shown on this, look up their electronegativity values, they're not identical, but they're damn close, carbon and hydrogen. So it's an equal sharing for carbon and hydrogen. That's why hydrocarbons in general, whether we're talking about gasoline or things that are in organisms, hydrocarbons are nonpolar. That's why gasoline does not mix with water. Water's polar. All right. Polar things like to be around other polar things. Nonpolar things like to be around other nonpolar things, but nonpolar and polar don't mix well. Well, an amphipathic molecule is polar and nonpolar, just at different parts of the same molecule. As we talked about for fats, the fatty acids are mostly hydrocarbon, or they're almost hydrocarbon, so fatty acids are nonpolar. And since that's all you have connected to the glycogen in a fat, fats are nonpolar. That's why oil doesn't mix with water. You put a drop of vegetable oil in a glass of water, the two are not going to mix. So fats are nonpolar. But phospholipids are only nonpolar at the hydrocarbon tails, the fatty acid tails. The phosphate group is beyond polar, right? It's fully charged because this oxygen that's part of the phosphate group is ionized. So they're not, they're polar means partially charged. This is even beyond polar. But it's on the same molecule. So this overall thing is amphipathic. And we usually draw these as cartoons, simple cartoon with a globular head indicating the part where the phosphate is. And that phosphate makes that part of it polar. And connected to that cartoon head is two tails representing the fatty acids. Well, the fatty acids, the tails, are fatty acids, but we call them hydrophobic, which linguistically means water-fearing, because they're nonpolar and therefore don't want to be around water, which is polar. And the head is hydrophilic, water-loving, because the charge of the phosphate makes them have no problem being around water, which is polar. Okay? That's just a single phospholipid. But obviously, you need a lot of them to form a plasma membrane. We're on slide 13 now. And remember, we talked about that Miller-Urey experiment, show you that just ordinary chemical reactions occurring in the prebiotic, before life, Earth. Reactions were taking place to create organic compounds out of inorganic compounds. right? Including amino acids, which are used to build proteins, as we'll see. But also, fatty acids were accumulating. And therefore, phospholipids were accumulating. You have 800 million years before any life occurred on Earth. That's a long time for these molecules to gradually be accumulating in the oceans, which is where life started. Well, once you get enough of them, they start interacting with each other. And you can still do this today. If you take a drop of, which is, you know, trillions and trillions of them, but just a normal eyedropper-sized sample of phospholipids, no life in it at all, right? It's just molecules. And you put that into pure water, no life at all, the phospholipids will automatically self-assemble into what we're looking at here, which is called a phospholipid bilayer. Bilayer meaning it's two layers. Each half of this is a monolayer. And this is just showing part of it. In three dimensions, it would form an entire sphere with some water inside it and water outside of it. The reason that this happens automatically is simply because these hydrophobic tails of the phospholipids are trying to avoid being around the polar water. So that one monolayer has its tails arranged next to the tails of the next monolayer. Therefore, all of these tails avoid direct contact with water either inside or outside. And the heads of each monolayer are in direct contact with water, which is what they like. They're hydrophilic. This one's in contact with the inside water. This one's in the contact with the outside water. Now, this is not a plasma membrane because a plasma membrane needs other things in it as well to function for a living cell. But these things were forming by the quadrillions before, and they're very cell-like already. They are the precursors to what eventually became the first cells, which are the ancestors to all of us.
So where would that be happening?
In the oceans originally, before there was any life.
So what happened?
Because these individual phospholipids are being created by the lightning and stuff that we were talking about before. So they're just accumulating. When it gets a high enough concentration, they're right next to each other, and so they form these little cell-like spheres.
What happens if it does get wet, though? Like if it does get warm?
Well, it will automatically. That's what I'm saying. You can, if you put it in pure water, it's going to form, just like if you put a drop of oil in water, it's not going to mix, right? But if you put another drop of water, those two droplets of oil are going to coalesce because they want to be around each other. And the reason that they do that is so that all of the molecules of the oil, except the ones on the edge, are not next to water. The ones in the middle are not in direct contact with water. They're trying to avoid it. Okay, 14. We're still in lipids, but this is a third category of lipids. What are we looking at here? You've looked at something very similar before. Actually, two molecules in a previous slideshow that looked very similar to this. Yeah. Testosterone and estrogen are what we looked at before. This is neither of those, but it's what both of estrogen and testosterone and all other steroid hormones are made out of. What is this?
Cholesterol,
exactly. Cholesterol is an animal molecule. Plants don't make it, but they make something similar called phytosterols. Phyto means plant. Cholesterol, by the way, means, well, the all tells you that it's an alcohol, right? Stere, as in stereo, means solid, meaning three-dimensional, and that's because of the ring structure. And coal means bile. So cholesterol means bile solid alcohol. It's a major component of bile, which the liver makes. It's what puts into the gallbladder and then gets squeezed into the digestive tract. But anyway, animals cannot live without cholesterol. for various reasons. I've already told you that cholesterol is the precursor molecule that all other steroids get made into. Cholesterol is made into all of the various steroid hormones, which we can't live without. Cholesterol also, though, is important as an animal a component of animal plasma membranes. By putting cholesterol molecules along with those phospholipids we just looked at, an animal can adjust the fluidity of the membrane. We'll talk more about that in a different chapter. All right, that's lipids. Brings us to 15. We're starting proteins now. And all along so far this term, I have been using the word polypeptide and the word protein more or less interchangeably. They are not absolutely interchangeable, and I'll explain why later. For now, I'm going to still continue to use them interchangeably. But polypeptide is the better word for the four categories of macromolecules, especially because, just like the word polysaccharide, polypeptide indicates that it's a polymer. And polypeptides, or proteins, are, of course, vital. No organism can live without proteins. Well, you can't. No organism can live without any of the four major categories we're talking about. They're all important for various reasons. But proteins seem especially vital because, compared to the other three categories, proteins have a lot greater variety of functions. Almost everything a cell does involves a protein of some sort. Other things can be involved as well, but a protein is involved. And I've already told you from day one that proteins are what give organisms their traits directly, right? Everything that you're able to do, how you look and everything, that's because of your particular proteins. Well, the reason that proteins have, as a category, have such a diverse set of functions, any given protein has its own function. It doesn't do all things. So these different categories of functions here are performed by different proteins. But proteins as a category have such a rich diversity of functions because, compared to the other three categories, proteins have much greater number of possible shapes. And shape is pretty much everything when it comes to proteins. Another name for the shape of a protein, which we'll use more often later, is conformation. Whatever the function is for any given individual protein, it has that function. It's able to do that thing because of its specific shape. And that's why I said pH was such a big deal, right? Because pH can change the shape of proteins as in acid rain. When you change the shape or the conformation, the protein no longer works. I usually don't read tables to you, but I will... Well, I can only start the table. I'm almost out of time. I will kind of read this one to you, though, at least the major categories. At the top, we have enzymatic proteins. In other words, proteins acting as enzymes. Well, we'll have much more to say about enzymes, but enzymes are examples of catalysts. A catalyst is something that drastically speeds up a chemical reaction. And... When in organisms, the organisms, catalyst is a word in biology and in outside of biology in chemistry. For instance, a catalytic converter uses platinum as the catalyst. But when a catalyst is occurring in an organism, when an organism makes its own catalysts, It makes them out of proteins, and we call those enzymes. Well, when I was talking about the cow earlier, it's a mammal, we're a mammal. Mammals aren't able to make the correctly shaped protein to work as a catalyst to break the glycosidic linkages between the glucoses. So that's why we can't digest it. But why would we not be able to? As we said, because we don't have the right gene. Genes are instructions for how to make proteins. If we were to become genetically modified, either by natural mutation or by manipulation, then we could have that gene and we could eat paper and get nutritive value from it. But we can't right now. Okay, I'm out of time.